Good morning. Please be seated. In the case of His Majesty the King against TJF, for the appellant, His Majesty the King Mark A. Scott Casey and Len Hubbard. For the respondent, TJF, David J. Mahoney Casey and Michelle James. Please note that there is a publication ban in this matter pursuant to sections 46.4 and 486.5 of the Criminal Code. Mr. Scott.
Chief Justice and Justices, we're not here today to discuss whether the trial judge erred in law in his appraisal of the Crown's case. Rather, we're simply here today to determine whether there is a reasonable possibility that that error may have had a material impact on the verdict of acquittal. We say yes for two primary reasons. First, by treating the evidence of violence throughout the course of the indictment, the trial judge turned this into a case of context and thereby neutered substantial evidence of the actus reus of human trafficking. Second, we say he correspondingly removed from the credibility analysis evidence that was capable of corroborating JD, at least to the core of her allegations, such that his concerns, as stated, might reasonably have been alleviated had he considered that evidence. If time permits, we maintain that the trial judge ignored Exhibits 3 and 4 in a substantive analysis of the case, and that the majority of the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal was wrong to have concluded otherwise.
Mr. Scott, pardon me.
Go ahead. Sorry. One of the issue here is, of course, as you mentioned, is credibility.
Yes.
And to what extent, as an appeal judge, we should not have deference for credibility, as stated by the first judge. So to what extent the error of law, we should consider this error of law as having an impact on the way the first judge evaluated the credibility of the victim. And, you know, he referred to many contradictory statements, different evidence. So I'd like to get your opinion on that.
Sure. The essence of the problem with the majority of the Court of Appeals decision is that they fail to understand that not only could context evidence not be used to establish the essential elements of an offense because it was just context evidence, but there was a corresponding inability of it to be used to enhance credibility of a witness standing alone. So by that, what I mean is, it's known the context evidence can only provide background to enable a trier of fact to understand probative evidence to the essential elements, but it otherwise has no corresponding effect on a credibility analysis. Evidence that is probative to an essential element has a necessary and proper byproduct of boosting the credibility of a complainant. So when the trial judge treated the evidence of the violence, including the evidence of JD regarding the violence, he pushed that to the background, and the corroborating nature of that evidence was removed from his credibility assessment such that...
You have just re-weighed what the trial judge weighed and found came down on one side of the balance. You've said he should have put it in the balance differently. You have directly said to us, sir, that we should re-weigh the evidence, come to our own conclusion, substitute that, and order a new trial.
With respect, Justice Rowe, we do not say that at all. We say that by relegating the evidence of the violence as well as the evidence of the witnesses themselves beyond simply the evidence of the violence. He removed from the credibility analysis evidence that was capable of corroborating J.D. by virtue of the fact that he determined that the evidence of the other witnesses and the evidence of J.D. as it related to violence was context evidence. He correspondingly said the only case for the Crown in this case was the testimony of J.D. Now it's...
Mr. Scott, he said more than that. I agree with you that he said in paragraph 57 that it was context, and he accepted as proven this violence, threats, intimidation. But I'm troubled by what he added toward the end of paragraph 57. He said, I cannot just assume from that context evidence that the human trafficking allegations are proven as against Mr. Heff. It requires the acceptance of J.D.'s evidence as credible and reliable to tie Mr. F. to the prostitution enterprise. So it seems to me that, yes, he accepted what he called the past discreditable evidence, but he said, I need to tie this to the prostitution enterprise or business. What do you have to say on that?
Well, we say that the trial judge did not tie the evidence of violence to the actus reus or to the credibility of J.D. because by virtue of the fact that he treated it solely as context evidence, he was prevented from doing so. And that is a critical aspect about the nature and limiting scope of context evidence that the majority of the Court of Appeal failed to appreciate.
Mr. Scott, it wasn't just the evidence of violence, although that is significant. It's also the evidence of K.L. that when he called me, and said, don't disclose what you found, whether it was on the computer or the internet, doesn't really matter, and said, don't disclose it or I'm going to call the authorities and you're going to lose your job. That evidence, it seems to me, crosses the Rubicon from the actus reus to the mens rea, because it goes to not just violence, but sexual activity. And the other evidence, it seems to me, also, some of it does, perhaps not as directly, the fact that they were they had lots of cash, going out every night to bars, the two of them. That also provides, it seems to me, evidence that goes to the mens rea as well and not simply the actus reus. So maybe the trial judge would reject that at the end of the day and say, well, but he doesn't actually treat any of that evidence. He deals with it as corroborative, bad character, and doesn't deal with it again, dismisses it and then doesn't deal with it again. So I think you may be understating it when you say the evidence of violence. I think it's more than just the evidence of violence.
Thank you, Justice Jamal. And in fact, you've stolen some of the thunder from our later submissions, because not only did the trial judge say that the evidence of violence was only context, but it seems, and it's plain from his decision, that once he concluded that, he only considered the evidence of J.D. So by only considering the evidence of J.D., and if there's any question about that, let's be clear, when he self-instructed about how to assess credibility of a witness, the factors that he self-instructed upon are only in relation to the testimonial factors of a single witness. At no point did he ever mention issues such as corroboration as potentially restoring a trier of fact's faith in an assessment of credibility, but he simply said, J.D. is the person upon which the Crown's burden rests. And I agree. Our submission is that by subjecting and removing and pushing the evidence off the playing field from the other witnesses, he ignored critical evidence exactly as you said, and it's corroborated between the witnesses. J.D. and the respondent went out regular and with increasing frequency at night. J.D. and the respondent went to nightclubs and to hotels as late as 3 a.m. for purposes that seemed to be inconsistent with this so-called catering business. The respondent had stacks of money when he otherwise had no source of employment. And as you stated, Justice Jamal, the evidence of K.L. about discovering the sexual ads on her laptop and confronting J.D., and then TJF's threat to her afterwards, certainly from the Crown's perspective, were germane to the mens rea. But because the trial judge didn't get past the actus reus, we submit he never got there. He's not going to consider whether the mens rea is made out until he gets to actus reus. Now, the Ontario Court of Appeal, in AA was astute to point out that the Crown is not required to prove actual exploitation. But in a case such as this, when we say that it was established, the court said that the issue of establishing mens rea, or the inference from it, is a relatively straightforward task.
Your friend's anticipating, I guess on the basis of paragraph 94 of the dissent, where the dissenting judge refers to the four lay witnesses, or at least three of them, as providing evidence that might have corroborated the evidence offered by J.D., your friends say at paragraph 7 of their factum, only J.D. provided testimony about the nature and extent of her participation in the sexual services industry, and that the respondent exploited her by coercing her to provide those services. The lay witnesses, say your friends, were unable to provide corroborating evidence respecting these issues. The trial judge's concerns about the credibility of J.D. thus led to reasonable doubt that the respondent was involved in the prostitution business and the corresponding acquittals. So I guess the accused and J.D. went out to bars and they came home late at night is a sign of something. But is it the sign, your colleagues think not, about the nature and extent of her participation, her labor and services that would go to the idea of exploitation? Where in the corroborating evidence, what are you exactly relying on? What's your path to show that the evidence of the four lay witnesses actually does provide this missing link, if you will?
Well, before answering your question, Justice, it's important to keep in mind that we're not solely considering the evidence of the four lay witnesses. We're still considering Exhibit 3 and 4 that we say that the trial judge entirely ignored. And that is the exhibits that had TJF's cell phone number, his mobile phone number, as the sole contact for prospective clients. That can't be taken out of the mix.
But to say that it was entirely ignored, does that not ignore paragraph 68 of his decision? He goes into the ads, he talks about the fact, that she admits that she's placed the ads. There was some inconsistency or evidence where she started out, I think, not saying that, and then as her evidence moved on, she did. But to say that he ignored it completely when, you do find reference to the ads, I think paragraph 64 or 68.
Well, paragraph 64 and 68, the trial judge never mentioned anything about exhibits 3 and 4, nor did he mention TJF's telephone number. What he did say was that on cross-examination, JD acknowledged that she placed some of these ads. But the reality here is, on the record, it was in direct examination that JD went into some detail that there were times where TJF was tired of sitting at the computer all day or thought that she had to start pulling her weight, as it were, and posting the ads. So when the trial judge, through his theme of how JD's direct examination and cross-examination showed stark contrasts, he was wrong in his characterization of that aspect in paragraph 68 and in 64 as it related to how it affected her credibility. He mentioned nothing about the telephone numbers themselves, though. And we submit that had he considered those telephone numbers, that would have had a substantial corroborating effect on anything that she might have said regarding the posting of the ads.
I don't mean to parse it, but 68 starts with on cross. J.D. acknowledged posting the ads in Edmonton, admitted providing names, numbers. Mm-hmm. I mean, so presumably that's phone numbers.
Sure.
So I guess I just took issue with your assertion that there was no evidence. I think you're pointing to we're pointing into 68 of the trial judge's concern about the ads and how he could deal with the ads.
Well, we submit that the exhibit itself or the exhibits were not considered. If we look at the final paragraph of the trial judge's decision, and I'm not trying to parse words here, but at paragraph 70 says, I suspect that there was a sexual business going on, but I'm not satisfied that TJF was involved. There was no context that there was a sexual business going on through the course of the trial. And those ads rendered any doubt about it completely unrealistic. So have you considered
that? I accept that. I think you look at the ads, you tie the ads into her. The ads would suggest very strongly, if not prove and establish beyond reasonable doubt, that particular, well, you don't have to establish a particular fact beyond reasonable doubt. The judge could have accepted that there was a business, that there was therefore a business, a service or a labor within the meaning of exploitation. It's the link in the ad that was of concern, I think, to the trial judge and to the majority of the Court of Appeal. To him, and what you have there, of course, acknowledged is, you know, he is a registered owner, and then the trial judge went on to look at the concerns, as did the Court of Appeal, about that issue.
Maybe you could go back to the question of my colleague, Justice Kersira, about what are the requirements for the mens rea for human trafficking?
Sure. Well, the mens rea requirements is that the accused person exploits or either exploits or acts in a way that has the purpose of having the person engage in this case, the sex trade. The question from Justice Kasserer was how it is that the four witnesses corroborated JD in that material respect. I think what we have to be very mindful of is that corroboration as a legal concept does not mean that these witnesses were required to touch on every single element of the offense or every single aspect of what JD testified to. Corroboration from witnesses or from exhibits is a legal concept that enables us to have restored faith or trust in the truthfulness of a witness's testimony, even if it doesn't touch on the essential elements of the offense. So to the extent that there was a corroborating value from those four witnesses, there's no requirement for a direct link. And we would submit that this is settled law.
But you've just set up, thank you for your lecture on the use of corroborative evidence. I found it very instructive. But you've set up a false framework here in the sense that the trial judge in the end said, I have a reasonable doubt as to the link between the violent activities and the complainant's provision of sexual services. Was he, in fact, causing her to do that? And you've said that the corroboration does not have to touch on every element of it. Well, of course that's true, but that's not the point. The point is that the trial judge weighed all the evidence with particular emphasis on the testimony of the complainant and said it's just not enough to meet the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the hill you've got to get over. And dancing around about corroboration doesn't have to touch on every element of the offense, I don't think helps you.
Well, Justice Rowe was answering the question of Justice Kasserer about where it is that the connections are drawn between the essential elements and the four witnesses that the trial judge moved into the background because of context evidence. But with respect, the trial judge mischaracterized the evidence of the violence as context and context alone, which as a matter of law meant, and he was aware of this, he was just wrong. As a matter of law, it meant he could not consider it in determining whether the essential elements of the offense were made out. It is the limit on context evidence. Context evidence has been determined to be dangerous because there's always the threat that the Crown is going to somehow, under some nebulous argument that it's context or narrative, push discreditable conduct into the equation. And its limits are something that the majority of the Court of Appeal failed to appreciate. The trial judge didn't. He recognized he was limited in what he could do. So he never said, the evidence of violence doesn't get me there. He said, I can't consider it at all. It's the majority of the Court of Appeal of paragraph 30 that said he concluded that the evidence of violence didn't get him over the hump. And the best way to try to articulate this, I think, is not from my words, but from the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal's decision of Downey, found in our condensed book at page 32. And in Downey, The court was citing, of course, with approval, being bound by BG. BG from this court cited with approval a High Court of Australia case, and I simply want to read out the underlined and emphasized part that's in the decision itself. At the end of the trial, the jury must consider all the evidence, and in doing so, they may find that one piece of evidence resolves their doubts as to another. For example, the jury, when considering the evidence of one witness by itself, may doubt whether it is truthful. But other evidence may provide corroboration, and when the jury considers the evidence as a whole, they may decide that the witness should be believed. We submit that the evidence of violence was pushed off the playing field, and whether by intention or by accident, the other evidence that Justice Jamal had outlined was likewise pushed off of the playing field. So all we had was J.D. standing alone.
But was it a problem, Mr. Scott, that, for example, the brother was viewed as, by the trial judge, as less reliable, that K.L., the babysitter, was not given the same credit as, say, the daughter? Does that affect your analysis at all?
In some ways, I mean, it's fair comment, but the Crown's position is that the trial judge piecemealed and considered all the witnesses pretty much on their own. First, he never went so far in his analysis of these particular witnesses to say whether he believed them or what it was that he rejected about their evidence or what he had concerns about, maybe in part because he said they don't provide anything that's substantive to the essential elements anyway. But we have to keep in mind, J.R., K.L., N.R., J.D., and J.C. all corroborated each other. They were mutually corroborating witnesses. So even though, when we look at them as a web, and my hands are coming across like this because in the interest of time, I wasn't going to get into it, but all I can think is when evidence is relevant and goes into a room, the room such as Actus Reus or Mens Rea, it doesn't stand straight up unconnected from the other evidence that's relevant to it. Crown's case is formed by a web, each strand supporting and supported by the other strands, and the only question is whether the Crown's burden can be borne by that web. But in this case, the trial judge treated KL's evidence by virtue of her testimony and her cross-examination alone, same with NR. JR, who he found to be credible, substantially corroborated them on both the issue of violence, on the issue of going out late at night, on the issue of KL babysitting frequently, the escalating violence itself, and the increased frequency of going out at times that weren't consistent with any kind of legitimate business enterprise.
Mr. Scott, presumably it's not simply corroborating the complainant, although you're relying on that. It could have actually made the conclusion on exploitation and purpose more believable. So it could have, quite apart from corroborating, but you do rely on that. And I wonder what you'd say about this. Yes, the trial judge doubted the complainant's credibility, but to me it doesn't, and I know we're not here as a trial court, but it doesn't really shake the foundation. Well, her finger wasn't cut off and hanging by the skin, but clearly it was something bad happened to her finger. She says she didn't get any of the money. Well, he doubts her on the basis that she was using $300 worth of cocaine a day in order to anesthetize herself for the sexual activity. So, yes, it's true. There may have been points where he doubted her, but it doesn't really take the case away from the bullseye of what you're advancing. So I don't know if that's trespasses beyond that these are essentially credibility findings on tangential issues that don't actually take the force away of the Crown's case.
Thank you, Justice Jamal. And, you know, that really gets to the heart of what we're seeing here. Much of what the trial judge had problems with in J.D.'s evidence standing alone involved her recounting traumatic events 10 to 15 years beforehand on, you know, minutiae of details while she's enduring a severely dysfunctional relationship and constant abuse. So he points out, well, she exaggerated about the injury to her finger, of course, but that was otherwise substantiated and believed by the trial judges otherwise proven. other aspects of adding details were all in relation to violence that was otherwise substantiated and proven. But when the trial judge pushed it back, all of this was relegated to context, and he was never, ever equipping himself with the value of that evidence in the overall credibility assessment.
So when we look at her credibility assessment on the Court of Appeal in paragraph 41 goes through with the issues with it, what's your response to that?
My response to that is that JD's testimony was the only evidence that the trial judge considered as to whether the Crown had met its burden. And maybe it couldn't have. We don't take issue with the fact that he
did it really this. When you look at, he did do a credibility assessment of each witness. And yes, he has that, I think was what, paragraph 51, when he says that it turns on her evidence. But didn't he also, though, do a credibility assessment of each witness?
That's probably part of the problem, Justice, because if you look at the witnesses themselves based on their testimony alone, you strip from the credibility assessment the fact that those witnesses can be corroborated by other evidence and by other witnesses. And there's nothing about the trial judge's treatment of either of those witnesses that suggests that he ever looked at the case as a whole. And perhaps it's best to have a look again, Justice Merton.
No, please go ahead and finish, because I'm in a different direction.
Okay. Perhaps it's actually worthwhile looking at this court's decision of BG again, and I realize that my time is running down, but this is important. At paragraph, at page 31 of her condensed book, at the very bottom of the page.
Sorry, which tab?
It's tab 9. Sorry, tab 8, page 32, 31. Tab 8, page 31. The court says, while the trial judge did outline the evidence of both key Crown witnesses, he considered their evidence separately and failed to consider the evidence as a whole. He first considered the evidence of the complainant in isolation and rejected it as unreliable. In this case, we say the four witnesses with respect to the violence and other corroborating pieces were set aside as opposed to rejected, even though we submit that he piecemealed their evidence. Then he moved to the evidence of the accomplice, stating that having found the evidence of the complainant unreliable, all he had left was the evidence of CZ. Here we have only the evidence of JD. Further, he looked only for discrepancies as to details in the evidence presented, did not consider the corroborative aspects of the evidence, and the numerous elements of the alleged offense, which were testified to by both witnesses capable of substantiating each other's story. This is the supporting and supportive aspect of the web that we're talking about. The trial judge also did not consider the corroborative aspects of the evidence relating to the broken glasses. And then at the end of the paragraph, I do not believe that the trial judge considered the individual pieces of evidence in the context of all of the evidence. Rather, the evidence was viewed without the support of other evidence. According to Moran, this amounts to serious misdirection. Now, if there's any doubt about the trial judge's reasoning process, recognizing, of course, that questions to counsel do not necessarily betray a legal error, when the trial judge was discussing with the Crown the value of JK and JC's evidence, he said, what am I supposed to make of those two witnesses? And the Crown said, well, they provide evidence with respect to violence. He said, is that the only inference that I can draw here? Maybe the other inference is that it's simply a dysfunctional home. And the Crown says, well, we also have the evidence of JD. And he says, I understand that, but I'm going witness by witness. With the greatest of respect to the trial judge, that is not the method by which the Crown's case is to be assessed. And we submit that it translated in his decision, both in his assessment of NR and KL on their own, with respect to their cross, as followed by the direct, and then in relation to JD. It was her testimony and the changes in her cross following her direct examination that the trial judge really hinged upon. Not only would we say that he was wrong factually, as opposed to where in the record it was that JD testified about a number of these things, but any assessment.
But henceforth, when we are looking at an appeal when someone has assessed credibility, we will apply the following yardstick, it seems, if we follow your counsel. The trial judge must first consider the credibility of each witness having regard to their own testimony, and then as a separate and distinct exercise, look at how that testimony touches on the credibility of every other witness. This is a somewhat comprehensive and complicated matter, which we, if we were to apply it on a regular basis, I think we'd throw out a lot of trial decisions.
We're not suggesting that there has to be any particular formula or any straitjacket on how trial judges consider the case as a whole. But the importance here is that a trial judge cannot disregard the interconnectedness of evidence and the interrelationship between probative and admissible evidence and its effect on credibility assessments. We're not saying you follow any particular formula or any particular roadmap, but at the end, you have to consider the evidence as a whole.
There's no one will argue with the statement of law that you just made. I must say I do get concerned when you point to a statement that a trial judge says in the course of an exchange with counsel to say, well, look, I'm just focused right now on this one thing, to say that that's somehow supports the fact that he didn't do the credibility assessment properly. I think that's what we worry about when we talk about parsing reasons, that let's not go into the record and parse an exchange between the trial judge and counsel.
That's fair, and thank you. I see that my time is up. Mm-hmm.
But you can conclude.
Okay, thank you. Justices, very simply, we submit that the failure of the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal to actually understand the limiting effects of context evidence led them astray in determining that the trial judge substantively considered the evidence of violence and how this was separate and never converging with the credibility assessment. We submit that that was a fundamental misunderstanding that fatally affected the majority's decision. I've spent the past 30 minutes speaking about what we submit the dissenting judgment very sharply, crisply, and concisely got right. And as a result, we would ask this court to rely on the dissenting reasons and order a new trial.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Mahoney.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and members of this honorable court. It is respectfully submitted that this appeal represents an attempt by the appellant to seize on an admitted error by the trial judge that bears no material effect on the actual outcome of the trial, and to use that error to justify the reversal of an acquittal that was based on an issue that was insulated from the error, which was the credibility of the main Crown witness, J.D. The respondent submits the Crown essentially is seeking to cloak their attack on the credibility assessment of the complainant in legal error, despite that the fact that the legal error, as found by the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal, had no bearing on the determinative assessment that only the Crown witness who could tie the respondent to the sex trade enterprise was not a credible witness.
If the error was insulated from the determination of the case, it's really because of the way the trial judge structured his reasons, and the taking the witness-by-witness approach one doesn't need to debate that. That's actually what he did. That's the structure of his reasons. He kind of picks off the witnesses one by one, says it's context evidence, and then when he gets to JD, says there's probably prostitution going on, when clearly there is, and says ultimately doesn't meet the burden. So there is siloing going on, it seems to me, on the structure of the trial judge's reasons. That isn't a matter of debate, it seems to me, because it's the way he sets out his reasons. So if it's insulated, I wonder that's because of the way the trial judge structured his analysis. Is that not fair?
I submit, Justice, I wouldn't agree with that, your interpretation of that. I submit that he did not silo all the witnesses, as my friend suggested, Indeed, he considered the evidence of all the witnesses. And indeed, that's clear in paragraph 57, when he says on the at paragraph 57 of his decision, which can be found at tab 5 of the condensed book, when he says that I'm satisfied from all the evidence that J.D. found herself trapped in a violent, unhappy, and loveless relationship with Mr. F. However, the charges before this court do not directly address the threats, intimidation, and injury that I accept as proven facts. So he considered all the evidence. He considered the evidence of what we call the lay witnesses.
But isn't it in that exact phrase that you cite there, that before this court, do not directly address threats, intimidation, and injury? And isn't that exactly what the Crown is arguing here, is that the limitation of seeing the threats and violence and intimidation is material? The narrow way that it was dealt with is an error of law, and it's material because it goes to, as I understand them, the actus reus of exploitation, her credibility, and to the purpose part of the mens rea. So he's saying right here that it doesn't, the charges do not directly, but isn't the error that the charges absolutely would turn on threats, intimidation, and injury?
Well, I think there what he's suggesting, Justice, is that the evidence that he's accepted from the witnesses, all the lay witnesses, the evidence of domestic violence, he's accepted that it is relevant to the conduct element of the offense. He's finding as fact there was violence, injury, and threats. So he is accepting their evidence, and that is corroborating the evidence of J.D. on the domestic violence aspect. But Justice Cody in this case, he's very concerned. This is not a case about assault causing bodily harm. It's not a case about assault, uttering threats, or damaged property. It's a case about human trafficking. And the focus of human trafficking is exploitation. So when he's referring to the charges before the court, he's referring to that exploitation aspect of the charges that is essential, and that the domestic violence of the witnesses that they can testify to does not address that exploitation issue, as discussed in the Sinclair case, that causation of J.D. being involved in the sex trade industry. They could not comment, they could not corroborate her evidence on that aspect. And that is the focus of Justice Cody, that aspect, that exploitative aspect of these charges. I think that's how I'm reading into that.
And when we read the end of paragraph 43,
43, yes, Justice.
The last paragraph of 43,
yes.
Says this type of evidence is admissible in that it establishes a pattern of dominant behavior by the accused, which allows the criminal conduct to exist in that environment. In this case, the exploitation of J.D.
That illustrates my point, Justice.
This is your point.
Yeah. That is my point. But his focus is the exploitation of J.D.
But even the exploitation point, if J.D. provided evidence through her testimony that would relate to the exploitation point, and the four lay witnesses provided evidence that would support, not directly, as your colleague points out, that specifically corroborate a specific instance, but give a description of the relationship that was consonant with an exploitative, wasn't it mistaken of the judge to say, as the dissenting judge says, that when she points to his paragraph 40-45, given that the four secondary witnesses could not provide direct evidence of the elements of the offense, it fell to J.D. to provide that testimony. Consequently, her credibility comes into play. So this idea of the isolation that you describe was created by the judge in lieu of his duty to consider the totality of the evidence. I think that's the argument from the other side.
I think it is the argument from the other side, Justice, but I submit that my friends are wrong on that point. Justice Cody did consider the evidence of the lay witnesses, but he also found that they could not testify to the exploitation aspect, this aspect of causing, Mr. F being involved in the prostitution offense, the sex trade industry. They could not give evidence corroborating his involvement. Only J.D. could. They could give evidence about the violence. In paragraph 31 of the judge's decision, he describes, based on the evidence of the daughter, J.R., that he was a brute. So he accepted the evidence that this person was violent. and that there was domestic violence, but none of the other witnesses could give credible evidence, and I'll discuss that in a moment, credible evidence that Mr. F was involved in the sex trade industry. And again, that's the focus of his decision. That's what sets these charges apart from assault causing bodily harm, normal criminal charges. It's the exploitation issue for which the lay witnesses could not give credible evidence. Now, my friend has suggested what KL did and NR did, but Justice Cody reviewed in his decision why those witnesses were not credible, and for very good reason. NR, the brother, lied about his cocaine use. He came up with evidence shortly before, or for the first time, he gave evidence in court about how he saw JD and Mr. F go out in the evenings. It required a concession by the Crown on the record that that's the first time he mentioned that, and that he was told he should let the Crown know ahead of time if there was going to be new evidence. There were several concessions by the Crown in this case about the challenging evidence of KL, about how some evidence came up at the last minute in court when people were advised that if there's anything further to come, let us know before trial. The Crown had to make a number of concessions in this case, which I submit was irregular, and which also would explain why the judge had some issues about the credibility of both JD and the other witnesses. But he did accept their evidence respecting the domestic violence, and we submit that that did establish the conduct element, but it could not establish the corroborative support for JD in terms of the exploitation issue. And as we note through the definition of exploitation under section, one more place.
So the Crown says in its, sorry, we.
I'm sorry, I was just going to review this legislation in relation to that matter. Yeah. Section 279.04 defines what exploitation is. And it's a person exploits another person, and this can be found on page 12 of the factum of the respondent, page 12. For the purposes of section 279.01, a person exploits another person if they cause them to provide or offer to provide labor or a service by engaging in conduct. But that aspect of cause and effect, if they cause them to provide, that's the exploitative issue. That is the issue for which only JD could provide evidence to the court, and for many reasons indicated in the judge's decision and in the transcript, the trial judge had questions about JD's credibility.
So your friends say at paragraph 92 of their factum that the evidence, the relevance of the evidence transcended violence, which, as you say, is not in dispute here, that the very conduct the Crown was relying on to establish the first element of the offense of human trafficking, control, direction, influence, was also relevant to the fault element of the offense and the necessary objective assessment of whether the conduct by the respondent would reasonably cause the complainant to fear for her safety. So those are elements of the offense, and as AA explains quite plainly, the elements of the offense are not singular. There's the conduct element, there's the fault element. And the Crown says the exercise of isolating JD's evidence from the rest precluded the judge from seeing plainly the elements of the offense that he was charged with measuring.
I submit, Justice, that he didn't isolate her evidence from the other witnesses. The other witnesses could not testify to it with respect to the exploitative aspect. It's acknowledged that the conduct element requires evidence of certain actions that control the movement. And if that conduct element is established, it still has to go to the next step that he intended to push her into exploitation or into sexual services, and that it had that cause and effect. We see that in the Sinclair decision, which is at tab 14 of the condensed book for the respondent. In terms of the elements of the offense. It's acknowledged that they don't have to prove exploitation, but the hard, concrete reality of this case is the Crown is alleging there was exploitation. The Crown Counsel said that in her submissions to the trial judge, and we submit that is the focus and the essence of this case. But in Sinclair, they talk about the elements. I would look to paragraph 12. First, paragraph 10 talks about the first element of the offense is an action by the accused must be a person who recruits, transfers, etc. And they also discuss the issue of influence. So we acknowledge that that aspect, the conduct element, may be satisfied here. But then it has to go further, though. The second element is the accused's actions must be for the purpose of exploiting or facilitating the exploitation of the complainant. That requires a connection, the connection that Mr. F, his purpose in the violent behavior was to exploit her and force her into the sexual industry. And that requires him to be tied to her involvement in the sexual industry. That was recognized by the trial judge at paragraph 57, that was what had to be tied, and he found that the evidence of JD was not credible in that respect.
But what about paragraph 15, looking to your left? Paragraph 15 in Sinclair, that goes through the list of different circumstances. So if we go presence and absence of violence, well, that is conceded, and the trial judge made such a finding based on the evidence of the others, the abuse of trust, power of authority. So I look at isolation of the complainant. He forced her to move towns, the nature of the relationship. It was her husband. He had control over her, the control over advertising of services. So the issue with the phone number, which was his, control of the financing. How is it explainable this guy had no job and had wads of money? So how do you get around that?
Justice, those factors do go to the issue of whether or not the conduct element is satisfied, and when it also looks at the aspect of the objective analysis of the complainant in terms of whether she may have felt threatened, and that these things can threaten her. However, it still requires that connection, as noted in paragraph 13, that the third element is that the accused causes the complainant to provide or offer or provide a service. That's an element that the accused causes the complainant to provide the service. And that required the trial judge to be satisfied that Mr. F was involved in forcing her to be involved in the sex trade industry. And he was not satisfied on that.
What about the last sentence? On that point, the last sentence of paragraph 41 of the trial judgment, because the trial judge says, most of KL's evidence focused on the relationship between JD and Mr. Fleming and offered little concerning the charges before the court. Surely, if the statement, the call from the accused to KL was believed, it wouldn't be simply background. It would actually be very relevant for his involvement.
Well,
and so when he says it was just on the relationship and didn't address the charges, surely that is a category error. And it sort of displays the fact that he was looking at the case through the wrong optic, even though he cites the relevant cases. He gets we all agree he got the actus reus fundamentally wrong. So the relevance of this evidence is not grasped, it seems, by the trial judge.
Justice, he also had difficulty with the evidence of Kale. He had other reasons of having difficulty with Kale as a credible
That's
witness.
Why I said if believed.
If believed, yes. And again, he had to assess her credibility. He had a number of problems. Even the Crown acknowledged there were challenges with the credibility of KL. They said they acknowledged that. She was caught changing her evidence in the midst
of. Do you agree that if believed, it tied him to the sexual services?
I'm sorry, Justice?
Do you agree that if believed, it ties him to the sexual services, which suggests that the last statement in paragraph 41 is incorrect?
I submit, Justice, it would indicate that he may, if the sexual services were going on and he's living with her, he would know she was involved in sexual services. It doesn't mean he was involved in the sexual services.
Well, if he calls the KL and says, makes a threat, don't tell anybody because otherwise you're going to lose your job because I'm going to take these steps to lose your job. That's more than just sort of, I mean, that's pretty significant, it seems to me.
It's something that could suggest that. It could suggest that. But again, another point I would make, Justice, is that KL, and there was evidence of KL and JD possibly colluding in terms of her evidence, and that was discussed during cross-examination. And that may have been in the mind of the trial judge as well in terms of assessing her credibility. Also, JD didn't hear him. She said he was angry. She didn't hear him call her and corroborate that aspect of it.
What do you make, Mr. Mahoney, of the position of the Crown, and indeed it's leaning on paragraph 110 of the dissent, that the judge didn't complete his analysis of the link that you're... The dissenting judge says at 110, the judge's failure to appreciate the importance of relevant, corroborative, and inculpatory evidence adduced by the Crown prevented him from contemplating the link between the respondent and his exploitation of the complainant. In other words, his analysis was halted prematurely. What are your views on that?
My views, Justice, are that Justice Van Naden, with the greatest respect, is wrong, that the trial judge did consider all the evidence and did not cut off the evidence. She had difficulties, or he had difficulties, with the evidence of the Crown witnesses, not just J.D. And he reviewed all that. And he reviewed the evidence of K.L. and N.R. and all the other witnesses, and as noted by Justice Rowe, as he should, in terms of what they said and how credible they were. That's a normal assessment of witnesses in a case. He did that, and he had difficulty with them. So I submit he did not, with respect to Justice Van Naden, cut off his assessment on the basis of that other evidence. He focused on J.D. because J.D. was the only one who could give evidence with respect to the exploitation issue that was before the court, which was the focus of the court.
I guess my question then is, she was the only one who gave direct evidence, but there were lots of factors that would have been relevant in addition to the violence and vulnerability, violence, financial gain. Those are other factors that would have been relevant. And my question to you is, did he consider those other factors when reviewing her, in doing his credibility assessment of her evidence?
I submit he did, Justice, because she was the only one who could give evidence with respect to those aspects as well, in terms of the finances and in terms of the number of aspects in the relationship.
Oh, but I think his finding as to the violence and to the nature of the relationship,
yes,
went beyond her evidence. That was established on any number.
Yes, and other witnesses as well. But certain aspects in terms of, for example, monetary control, he found she changed her evidence in 2000.
He didn't have another source of income, and that doesn't come just from her.
That's
the others
correct.
Say he wasn't working.
Yes.
He had money, he wasn't working.
Yes.
So I guess my only my biggest concern in this case is whether, in fact, the credibility finding was made in isolation of the other factors that would have brought to bear on this issue of causation.
Justice, in his decision, he did review all the other factors. When he went through the different witnesses, including J.D. and K.L., and the mother, the daughter, all those witnesses, he did review that evidence. It was clearly before him. We know from REM and other decisions, when the judge is giving his decision, he does not have to review every aspect of the evidence or every aspect of the law. But he clearly understood it. It was put to him by Crown Counsel in her written and oral submissions. These issues were before the court. But in his credibility assessment, and really does come down to his credibility assessment of J.D., there are so many factors that troubled him that he simply could not find that Mr. F. was tied to the business. He says he might be, but he could not find beyond a reasonable doubt that he was tied to it to the extent as required under Sinclair that he was causing her to be involved in the sexual trade industry. He simply had many difficulties with J.D.'s evidence and the evidence of other witnesses.
So if I understand your answer to that, there was just so much that was problematic with her evidence that he didn't need to consider her evidence or credibility in light of the other factors.
There was so much difficulty with her evidence, Justice, that the case required her credibility to be accepted. And because it wasn't, despite the other aspect that may corroborate that he did review, that was not sufficient to rehabilitate the difficulty in credibility. And I believe that the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal addressed that in paragraph 57 of their decision. One moment, please. This talks about the phone numbers, but I submit it also is reflective of the other aspects of the evidence that this Honorable Court have referred to. Paragraph 57 of the Court of Appeal decision. In the end, the significance of the presence of TF's phone numbers on the ads posted by J.D. could be relevant to her credibility as potentially corroborative concerning TF's role in exploiting her to provide sexual services for money. But credibility findings the weighing of evidence and the sufficiency of evidence, as well as the existence of reasonable doubt, are questions of fact for the trial judge, and the judge's conclusion that he had reasonable doubt about TF's involvement in any sexual services enterprise was largely dependent upon his doubt about JD's credibility, unassailable by the Crown on Appeal. So he acknowledges that there may have been some other aspect, the trial judge may have seen other evidence that perhaps corroborated JD's evidence, but his overall difficulties with their evidence, for many reasons, which are set out in the trial judge's decision. I counted a number, nine new aspects of her evidence were introduced at trial. The Court of Appeal focused on that in paragraph 41 of their decision. And she denied that she was told that she could contact the Crown. After she met with the Crown in August of 2021, she was told, look, if you have anything else between now and trial, let us know. And disclose it now. She denied that, and the Crown had to make another concession that she was told. And she had nine new aspects of the evidence that came out at trial. Wasn't mentioned 2013, wasn't mentioned 2018 during the police statements, not mentioned in August 2021. These create problems for a trial judge when assessing credibility. And then there's the list of number of items, paragraphs 59 to 69, and the trial judge's comments at paragraph 58 about her demeanor. We're dealing with the cold, soulless transcript before the court. There's the aspect of the trial judge watching witnesses testify, and his comments at paragraph 58 are not to be dismissed. He says, I find that J.D. was often prone to exaggeration and hyperbole. She added phrases to her answers that were directed to Mr. F. instead of the court. I was left with the impression J.D. viewed Mr. F. as a captive audience. While such behavior is totally understandable, given the couple's violent relationship, it seriously detracted from her evidence. I find that J.D. recognized her testimony was lacking on certain points. In those situations, answers were given that were in variance with accepted testimony. In other words, I had concerns she was filling in the blanks to comply with her narrative. My view of J.D.'s testimony after direct was significantly altered by her cross-examination. That's in addition to the specific points that can be directed, he's pointed out in his decision, of inconsistencies. That's in addition to the new information being provided at a trial. That's in addition to her denial that she was told that she should notify the Crown. There were many difficulties with J.D.'s evidence and also significant difficulties with the other Crown evidence, and those things weighed in the minds of the trial judge when he was determining whether or not the Crown had proven the case beyond a reasonable doubt. Justices, this is a Crown of, it is an appeal and of acquittal. The Crown has a heavy burden to establish an error in law alone, and then that error must have made a material bearing on the acquittal, and that the verdict would not necessarily have been the same. We submit there was an error, but that the error committed by the trial judge was not material and did not affect the outcome of the trial. This is a situation where he did accept the evidence of the lay witnesses, although he mischaracterized it as lay evidence, disreputable conduct evidence. He did apply it. He did accept it. He acknowledged that he didn't put it through a probative versus prejudicial effect, probative value versus prejudicial effect analysis. He accepted it and found it relevant to the issue of whether or not there was the violent conduct of that was testified to by J.D. He applied it for that purpose. My friend has suggested that by characterizing it as bad character evidence, somehow that was lost and was no longer applied when considering the credibility of J.D. Well, for starters, he did apply it to the credibility of J.D. in terms of corroborating her evidence of domestic violence. For my friend to suggest then that, well, he didn't consider that evidence, because he called it bad character evidence, it did not get applied to the other aspect of her credibility, the exploitative evidence, we submit that the reason he didn't apply it to the exploitative evidence was because those witnesses could not testify to that aspect. And that's acknowledged by the Nova Scotia Court of Appeal and by the trial judge. That evidence was relied on by J.D., and that was the issue that she had to address. And again, for many reasons, the trial judge found her evidence to be non-credible. Justice, subject to any further questions, those would be the comments on behalf of the respondent.
All right, thank you very much. Any reply?
Justices, I intend to be very, very brief. I have four points to make in reply. And the first is, my friend has stated repeatedly that the trial judge considered all of the evidence. Considering all of the evidence is substantially different from considering the evidence as a whole, and we say it's in the latter where the trial judge failed. Second, as a matter of the trial judge's decision, he never ever stated that he was considering the violence as evidence of conduct in relation to section 279.01, because quite frankly, he adhered to a self-instruction on context evidence and he could not consider it for that purpose. So even though those witnesses corroborated JD with respect to violence, that piece of corroboration and that aspect of the evidence simply got pushed off of the playing field when he came to assessing whether Crown met its substantive burden. Third, by the time this matter got to appeal, there were three facts that were uncontestable as a result of the trial judge's decision. Throughout the whole time period of the indictment, TJF subjected JD to increasing and escalating violence. At the exact same time, it was uncontestable that she moved from menial, legitimate work into the sex trade. Nobody questioned that she was involved in the sex trade here. And finally, we have this ad. Now, to get back to Justice Moreau's question and in response to my friend's comments in his oral argument, if we apply common sense and human experience to this ad or these ads, JD had her own telephone number. She used it for the user number for contact. Why is she going to put, as the only contact to prospective clients, a telephone number that she did not have exclusive access to? Her testimony was she occasionally answered calls. Nobody suggested that TJF did not have the phone that was linked to that number. And quite frankly, if she's not providing a number that involves somebody who is totally knowledgeable about her engagement in the sex trade, that's bad business. And she posted it twice. The exhibit showed that she posted it in March of 2009 and again in May of 2009. It just makes no sense that this is the manner by which her prospective clients are going to be communicating for sexual services. And finally, my friend suggests that JD's evidence was irretrievably lost, regardless of the corroborative potential of the other witnesses. This brings to mind perhaps the most stark aspect of why corroboration is important, and that's with respect to Vetrovic witnesses. The most unsavory, deceitful, and untrustworthy witnesses that come across the criminal courts. And the instruction is, it's dangerous to convict on their evidence alone, but what do you look for? Independent corroboration. And with respect, the trial judge in this case pushed all of it aside. And of the three uncontroverted facts that I outline were present by the time this matter got to appeal, the only fact was whether JD was engaged in the sex trade. Those are my comments in reply.
May I just ask one question? Sure. How do you say the error about the evidence of violence goes to the mens rea component? I understand your argument on actus reus and credibility.
Well, we submit that, you know, especially when it comes to the issue of exploitation, that the connection between actus reus and mens reus, if exploitation is actually proven, is not particularly far apart, right? One leads into the other, and some of the evidence could be mutually relevant. So the telephone call that KL described and the ads themselves, they certainly would speak to mens rea, but also may be relevant to the issue of actus reus, the conduct aspect. But as it relates to the evidence being relegated, we submit that when the trial judge said, I don't have any evidence of actus reus, he didn't have to engage in the issue of mens rea because he simply didn't go that far in his analysis. He nipped it in the bud. He completely neutered the Crown's case from the beginning of his analysis.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your submissions. The court will take the case under advisement.